Welcome in, first edition underway, Double Play Podcast. I'm Dustin Sweetelson, the man with me right here, Adam Burke. Some of you know us from VSiN, others getting to know us here, so we figured we'd say hi. Welcome you into our podcast here. Going to do a ton of baseball discussions throughout the season. Thrilled to be with you. Adam, of course, for those that don't know, you can find him over on Twitter/X at Skating Tripods. He is an analytics nerd. Me, I am anti-analytics since 2003 when I hit 292 my senior year of high school, Adam, and my on-base percentage was, as you guessed it, also 292. What's going on, buddy?
I like the symmetry there. Good start to the show, as always, from Dustin Sweetelson, who does a great job over at VSiN. He's producer of Sharp Money, also the co-host of Sharp Money, and then doing, is it still called Live Bet Sunday?
It is still called Live Bet Sunday, whether or not we do have live bets. I mean, I always have live bets because it's an issue that we can discuss at another time. It's more meant for my therapist, that actual conversation.
Well, your therapist is maybe the busiest person out here in Las Vegas, so I give them a lot of credit for what they have to deal with. But yeah, I'm the managing editor over at vsin.com. I write a daily baseball betting article and of course, do guest spots across the network as well. So, as Dustin said, this can be a baseball podcast, but we'll definitely work in some betting stuff, sprinkle that in as we get deeper into the season here for all of our listeners that are new to us, and frankly, we're new to them. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, Adam, I guess what's interesting about you and I being paired up for this is we both equally love baseball, but we both look at baseball very differently. I mean, it's more of an intelligence thing for me. The analytics kind of go over my head. You've taught me what to look for, over the last year or so here as we've gotten to know each other. But analytics just kind of go over my head because I'm not great with numbers, but I just love baseball. I mean, I grew up in New York. Mets fan, absolutely tortured soul. Maybe that's why we get along, because you're a Guardians fan and you are just as much a tortured soul.
Yeah, I don't know if any soul is tortured more than that of an Indians/Guardians fan. I mean, a couple of World Series Game 7 losses and most of our lifetimes here. But look, I mean, I grew up with the 90s Indians. Cleveland born and raised. Vegas is the only place I, have lived outside of Cleveland. So I grew up with the 90s Indians, who were really, really damn good. And a team that it's a shame that they never actually got over the hump and won a World Series. Of course, had two cracks at it, 95 and 97. But then, Dick Jacobs sold the team in the early 2000s to Larry Dolan. And now his son Paul Dolan is kind of the controlling owner. But it was one of those things where then they cut payroll. And it wasn't just because they were cheap. It was because Cleveland was undergoing a lot of transformations. They were losing Fortune 500 companies from downtown. The population was moving further and further away. So they weren't going to go to weeknight baseball games, 7 o'clock first pitches on a Wednesday night, something like that. So they kind of had to reimagine things. And one of the things that they did was really dive into the analytics. So as I was growing up, as I was learning more about my own baseball fandom, I became a student of sabermetrics, a student of analytics, a lot of data-driven analysis for me, both with my betting and also just the way I think about baseball. So that was kind of the environment that I sort of matured and raised myself in as a baseball fan, where I went from a team that just scored like 9 runs per game because they were full of dudes that could rake, to a team that had to play platoons all the time.
Yeah, I mean, like Kenny Lofton, Paul Sorrento, Jim Thome, Vizquel, Alomar, Manny Ramirez, young
Albert
Manny
Bell.
In right field. Just an absolute loaded childhood of stars. Then you go from that to Kareem Garcia in right field as one half of a platoon. I understand that. And I guess that would make sense, too, like for both of our baseball journeys here, right? Because for me as a Mets fan, I grew up in the 90s and I was tortured with all my friends being Yankee fans. So I'm in New York. And the Yankees are winning every World Series. And they're buying up every player that matters every offseason. And everyone wants to be a Yankee. They're even going international. They're grabbing, El Duque and Jose Contreras from Cuba. Like, they're bringing over Matsui from Japan. Like, they are the model organization. They're spending all this money. And I'm a Mets fan watching Chico Walker and Tim Bogar up the middle at times. Like, it's just... When you watch another team in your same city spend money, all you want to do is spend money. And what's crazy about the Mets is every time they've opened up the wallet, outside of like 2006, that core should have won a World Series, and they did go to the postseason multiple times, but spending money has not worked for the Mets. So kind of ironic that both of our journeys with baseball, you love analytics because your team adopted it. I never got into it because my team would just open up the checkbook every now and then and try and make a splash, and it just wouldn't work.
Well, and I think that's what's going to make this show pretty interesting. Not only the two different perspectives that we come from, but also, I mean, our favorite teams have been roller coaster rides throughout, you know, the vast majority of our lifetimes here. You know, it's not like being a Dodgers fan where, I mean, what, they've made the playoffs, was it 12 seasons in a row, 10 seasons in a row, whatever it is, you know, and then, you know, had some other playoff appearances in the 2000s, or being a Yankees fan where you've got, you know, all those championships, everything like that. And nothing against those fan bases. Shit, I wish I could be, you know, the fan of a team that wins all the time. But, you know, I think that it does kind of, I think in some respects kind of makes us appreciate baseball more because,
oh yeah,
you get those super special moments that, you know, anytime that the Guardians slash Indians make the playoffs, like it feels like a huge deal to me.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, they did it a ton when I was a kid, and then for a long time, they just weren't a very good team. And now they kind of picked it back up. And, you know, if there are any Cleveland fans that are listening, they're on the older side. They're like, you know, hey, fuck this kid. Like I grew up with the 60s and 70s Indians that, you know, I mean, they were an embarrassment. You know, they were a joke. So, you know, I guess maybe I've had it better than some. But look, you know what? I think the key takeaway here is that you and I love baseball, and we love baseball in different ways. And I think it's a really good balance here for the show.
For sure. For sure. Well, you mentioned the Dodgers. We might as well start with them because, you know, they decided to go NFL style. The NFL doesn't have an offseason. They steal headlines every week. The Dodgers in the baseball offseason stole the headlines every single week. I guess I want to start overview with them just because, Adam, like Otani, Yamamoto, Glasnow, Teoscar Hernandez, when you look at what LA added, and this goes back to my therapist, how much of their motivation is from trauma? And the trauma would be everyone out there just constantly talking about how their World Series title in 2020 doesn't really count.
Yeah, I think it's a really fair point. I mean, you know, the thing that I kind of said in my team preview for the Dodgers is like, this is 162 games of spring training. Like nothing matters for them until the month of October, because this is the poster child, the perfect example of a World Series or bust team. And that's it. That's all that matters. If they don't win at all, it is a failure of a season. And look, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, they have spent money. I mean, not only have they spent money, they're spending money into like the 2050s with all the deferrals that they have and all of that. So, I mean, they are as all in can possibly be here to win this thing. And look, I mean, they are a loaded team. You know, I mean, you already had Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman there. As you mentioned, you bring in even a guy like Teoscar Hernandez has 30 homer upside. Like, is he Shohei Ohtani? No, but he's a potential 30 homer guy. The bullpen is the same group as last year, which is just fine. But, you know, look, I mean, what'll be really interesting to watch for the Dodgers as the season goes along is, you know, I mean, first of all, will Tyler Glasnow stay healthy? Because he hasn't throughout his major league career
ever.
We don't know what Yamamoto is going to do his first year in the U.S. And, you know, spring training kind of is what it is, but there were some location issues, and then he didn't pitch well in that first game in South Korea either. But then, I mean, they have a major league rotation on the injured list right now.
Yeah.
Dustin. Walker Buehler, Tony Gonsolin, Clayton Kershaw, Dustin May, Emmett Sheehan. That's like a probably league average-ish type of rotation on the injured list.
With the upside to be like multiple potential all-stars there.
Right. It's absurd.
Yeah, look, they're freaking loaded, man. But here's the thing I love about baseball is we had two teams in the World Series last year that, if you want to go back to betting here, were the Rangers were like 45-1. I know the Diamondbacks were probably 70 or 80-1. I only know 80-1 because I got 80-1 in season on them when they dipped. But like the beautiful thing about baseball is you could have the best roster on paper. It doesn't work out just because you're the best team. I mean, or have the best players. Like, look at football. Patrick Mahomes limits how many teams can win the Super Bowl because he exists. And there's a few other players, you know, their existence alone limits how many teams can win the Super Bowl. In baseball, I think it's always wide open. Last year was an example, and I'll use the Braves winning a World Series without their best player, Ronald Acuna Jr., when he was hurt, as another example of, like, you don't have to have the best, most talented roster to make a run, especially with the new playoff format.
Well, and remember, if you think back to that Atlanta team in 2021, I mean, you could get them 50-60 to one at the start of August because of where they were in the standings. I mean, they were a really pedestrian team for a while. I mean, going into the month of August, they were 52-55. But then they ran into, you know, a really, really soft schedule in August. And then by the end of the month, they were up two games in the NL East. And that was even with losing a couple games to the Dodgers to finish out the month. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the I think it's just kind of the nature of baseball, the individualized battle of hitter versus pitcher that just creates, you know, a lot of variance, a lot of volatility. Over the course of 162 games, the best teams will be the best teams. Like, it will be very surprising if the Dodgers don't win 100 plus games and win the NL West by, you know, maybe double digits. Who knows? We'll see. I mean, at least Arizona, you know, going out and getting Jordan Montgomery, and, you know, credit to them, not only going for it, trying to, you know, kind of double down on the success they found last year, but ownership kind of always tells these guys, hey, we'll spend when the time is right to spend. The time is right to spend for Arizona, and they did. And the players acknowledged that publicly with the media, which I thought was a really cool thing there. But look, I mean, that was a Diamondbacks team. Sports odds history says they were 125-1 as of May 30th or March 30th, excuse me, to win the World Series. And they got there. So that is the thing. I mean, over the regular season, the good teams will be good. But when you get to the playoffs, there is this degree of volatility, this degree of variance that makes for really compelling television, not only overall, but just from pitch to pitch.
You mentioned the Montgomery thing. I guess this is something worth discussing. It's like, has Scott Boras lost his fastball? Like, Scott Boras, super agent to all these baseball stars, and he's done a great job getting a lot of guys paid for a long time. Remember, it's guaranteed freaking contracts in Major League Baseball. But he had Cody Bellinger, Blake Snell, Matt Chapman, J.D. Martinez, Jordan Montgomery, all these guys looking for, you know, 150, 200, $300 million deals, whatever they were asking for. And none of them came close. A lot of them are on, like, they're going to make a lot for 1 year and then they're going to go back into the market and look for another gig. Like, Scott Boras holding baseball hostage, I think, killed a lot of its momentum this offseason. And in the end, his bluff was called and his guys didn't get the offers he was looking for. I just think Scott Boras, his way of doing things is hurting the game, one, but two, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I think he's a guy who needs to adapt. You know, it's kind of the money line or the money ball line, you know, adapt or die. I think that, you know, Boras kind of has to adapt here. And also, I mean, look, you're in a situation now where Mike Rizzo, you know, the GM of the Nationals, isn't just bailing Boras out by paying all of his dudes, because, you know, those guys had a really, really strong relationship. And I mean, it got the Nationals a World Series flag. It's, you know, kind of crippled them in a lot of the other years, but it got them a flag that'll fly forever. So I think it's a trade off that you make. But yeah, you know, for Boras, I mean, you know, another thing I think is going to be really interesting going back to the Dodgers for a second here is all of these deferrals, right? I mean, they just signed Will Smith, their catcher, to a 10-year, $140 million deal. Bunch of deferrals in that. There's, as we know, I mean, Shohei Ohtani's salary is $2 million a year, technically, because of all the deferrals that he has in his contract. Like, I don't think Boras has any interest whatsoever in this deferral bullshit.
No.
I think he wants all the money right now. And the question becomes, with the Dodgers doing this and kind of setting this precedent, are more free agents and more organizations going to be willing to do this? And if so, is that something that Boras and some of the other, you know, power players in Major League Baseball are going to do? Are they going to agree to that? I don't know, but I think this deferral thing is really shitty for baseball, especially as a fan of a small market team where, I mean, we're kind of up against it anyway. But, like, and I get the argument. People are saying, well, your team can do this too. Sure, they can, but how many organizations can withstand paying some guy in, you know, 2042 who hasn't played for the team in 8-10 years, you know, withstand paying him $15 or $20 million for a season he's not playing in? So I'm curious to see how that all kind of plays out, and also how maybe to some degree it could shift the power dynamics of, you know, of the agent and GM and team president types of relationships.
No, I think it's totally fair. I think it's kicking the can down the road to avoid the luxury tax, obviously. And at some point, you're going to have to pay the piper there, right? So you're going to have to pay these guys, and it's going to hit you on the books. So I guess it's about going for it. And I mean, this is a motto I've lived by for a long time, is all moves are justified if you win a ring. So if they win a ring with these guys on the roster, all these moves were justified, even if it means the Dodgers down the road have to penny pinch to make things work because they're paying so many guys deferred salaries.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the Kansas City Royals, right? I mean, you know, they went 81-81 in 2016 season, the year after they won the World Series, 80-82 after that. They haven't won more than 74 games since. would that fan base trade, you know, that 2015 season for anything? Absolutely not. The championship to me is all that matters. I mean, I would have 25 years of bad Guardians baseball just for one ring, man. That's all I want is
you,
one.
You triggered me because you mentioned 2015. So 2015, I'm living in Washington, D.C. Obviously, the Mets every single night, living and dying with this young pitching core, obsessed with Harvey Days and DeGrom coming on the scene. Funny story about DeGrom. When he made his debut the year before, my buddy and his girlfriend were watching a game with us, and he had the long hair at the time. And my buddy's girlfriend was like, "Oh man, who's that guy? I love his hair." And I was like, "Don't get used to it. You're never going to hear from him again. He's nobody." Because DeGrom wasn't like, he wasn't as hyped up as the other Mets pitching prospects. Like, I knew he had good minor league numbers, but I thought, you know, there's been a lot of these guys that have gotten called up and then moved to the bullpen who have live arms. I was like, don't get used to it. He's not someone worth remembering. Meanwhile, goes on a run where he's like an all-time great, just an all-time great, arguably the best pitcher of his generation at his peak. But 2015, I was afforded the opportunity because my college roommate, who I went to school with, ended up being the minor league voice for one of the Mets affiliates, Adam. And he's like, "Hey, man, I know you're a Mets fan. If you can make it up here, I've got a free ticket for you." So I went to two games in the NLCS against the Dodgers, and I went to two World Series games, including the one where they lost it to the Royals, the final game where Matt Harvey came out to a pop that was like a WWE event. We went nuts waiting to find out if he was coming out to pitch the last inning. There was a big delay. It was almost like they built up the anticipation. And all of a sudden, he comes sprinting out of that dugout, dude, and we screamed. And this is going to sound sick, but I know the Mets didn't win that World Series, but like, I would never trade that moment for anything. The moment of like, this guy wants the ball. He's been dominant all night against this Royals lineup. I don't want to go to the bullpen and Jerry's familiar right now. Let Harvey keep doing his thing. And when he jumped out of that, and he jumped out of the dugout, I mean, the place went so crazy. I still have it saved on my phone. And every time I want to like get emotional, I'll watch it. A little tear will stream down my face because it was just that special.
You know, my wife and I, we were season ticket holders in 2016 for the Indians, and we had been season ticket holders a little bit off and on throughout the decade. It was also the time where like you could get an upper deck ticket for $6 and just go to any game that you wanted to, which was really nice because we like to stand on the home run porch. In fact, that's where we got married, at Progressive Field on the home run porch. And, you know, season ticket holders in 2016, and like the game seven, clearly a roller coaster in so many different ways. We were surrounded by Cubs fans. I mean, it was like 51-49 Guardians and Cubs fans, or well, Indians fans, I guess, because it was so much cheaper to just go to Cleveland and go to a game than it was to get a secondary market ticket at Wrigley. And the Rajay Davis home run off of Aroldis Chapman, I'm in my late 30s. So that was the best Indians baseball moment of my lifetime.
Yeah.
I have watched that video once since that game because they lost the game. Like it is an incredible moment, a shocking moment for a guy like Rajay Davis to hit a home run, you know, barely leaks it inside the foul pole. I've watched it once because my thought, and maybe this is kind of the data driven analyst in me, they lost the fucking game. That's all that matters to me. I don't care that they tied it. They lost the game. So I've watched it one time since that moment that I was there for.
You know what? That might be a good social thing. At Skating Tripods for Adam, at Dustin Sweetelson on Twitter/X. Hit us with like the moment with your team that you go back to and you get emotional about. It could be like ours where like in the end, the team didn't finish the job and win the World Series. Or it could be one where, you know, they got it done and you just think about it all the time, have video on your phone, whatever it is, you go on YouTube and you want to relive the moment because those two obviously jumped out to us. The Rajay Davis homer, I remember being like, oh no, oh no, oh no, Cleveland's done. And then he just tanks one. And by the way, the fact that it's Rajay Davis is what makes it even more special. Just a guy who's known for stealing bases, not hitting homers. I think that's what makes that moment so great.
I swear to God, though, Michael Martinez had the most important plate appearance of my lifetime. And he may be one of the five worst hitters in Major League Baseball history. Like, I have been told, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I have been told that there was a discussion in the dugout as to whether or not to pinch hit pitcher Josh Tomlin for Michael Martinez. Now, Tomlin's a pitcher who was okay with the bat, and if he had been in the National League, he probably would have been a decent hitter. I think he was a shortstop coming up out of Texas, Katy, Texas, I believe. But there was a, from what I've heard, a legitimate discussion of having a pitcher pinch hit in a very high leverage spot in the World Series because of the way that it had gotten to that point. And of course, I don't want to get into the rain out or the rain delay and all of that, but I tell you what, man, it's incredible. You know, you watch enough baseball, you see a lot of things. I've seen an unassisted triple play. I've been at a no hitter.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen a 4-homer game or a 20 strikeout game, and Shane Bieber or Corey Kluber should have had one against the Cardinals back in, I believe it was 2015, but I've seen a lot of shit, man. And
I watched the Mets.
It's all exciting.
I watched the Mets bat out of order, like recently, like in the major leagues. Like, you do see everything on a baseball field. It's freaking crazy. All right. Well, let's look ahead to the season just a little bit. I just want to look a little bit ahead to the season because I think I want to ask you this. This is driving me nuts. As an analytics guy, can you explain to me why all the number nerds are out here telling me that the Baltimore Orioles are going to regress? When I look at them and I say they have a lot of young players, they added Corbin Burns, and by my math, young players tend to get better. So why is everyone saying the Orioles are going to regress?
Yeah, I think a lot of it kind of has to do with the starting rotation where, you know, Tyler Wells last season, he did something that you really never see. He had a 3.64 ERA with a 4.98 FIP. And this is a guy who gave up, you know, 48 or 25 home runs in 118 and two thirds, 48 earned runs total and 25 home runs. So like, this is a guy who was remarkably fortunate when he did allow guys on base, but he gave up a bunch of home runs. So the advanced metrics really don't like home runs, especially FIP, because FIP, there's only four components to that. And that's fielding independent pitching, strikeouts, walks, hit by pitches, and home runs, which is quote unquote, the things that a pitcher can control. Well, what he was able to control was apparently giving up a lot of home runs. So the numbers don't really like him a whole lot. I don't think there's a lot of belief in Dean Kramer or Cole Irvin, but Corbin Burns is a really nice addition for a variety of different reasons. Grayson Rodriguez was terrific when he came back up from the minor leagues. And like, this offense is going to rake. I mean, they have so many dudes who aren't even here yet, let alone the guys that are. So they're just going to get better, I think, offensively as the season goes along. I think it's the back end of the rotation that people are concerned with. I think Felix Bautista being out really hurts them as well.
Yeah.
Craig Kimbrell is not Felix Bautista, even though he's still, you know, a serviceable reliever and a decent closer. I think it's just that, Dustin. But, I mean, as you said, this lineup will keep getting better. And this is a group of guys that are just kind of getting to the big league level, and they're going to learn pitchers a little bit more. You know, Colton Cowser is a guy who's going to hit for them. They still have Kobe Mayo coming up in the minor leagues too. Jackson Holliday is the number one prospect in baseball. It won't take long for him to be up. Honestly, I don't want to spoil anything from a question you're going to ask me later on in the show, but I think the Orioles are legitimately very, very good and here to stay for a long time.
Yeah, and they have new ownership. And I think that's going to factor into how they approach the trade deadline, how they approach who's still out there potentially to add some depth within the organization. I think when you look at what's gone on with the Baltimore Orioles for a long time, it's a team with a lot of history that should be doing a lot more winning than they've done. Now, granted, they didn't win a lot. That's why they were able to draft all the players that they were. But now they almost have a logjam. They have too many young position players. They need to start spinning some of them into some major league pitching.
It looks a lot like the Houston Astros, right? I mean, the Astros were bad for a very long period of time and to some degree, maybe tanked, you know, a couple of those seasons there. But I mean, they wind up, you know, that Kyle Tucker was a first round pick. Alex Bregman was a first round pick. You know, Hunter Brown was a guy who, you know, was only a fifth rounder, but a guy that they developed really, really nicely here. And then the nice thing is once you get those young core players that come up through your system, you get all those first round picks to hit. I mean, obviously, the Yordan Alvarez, Josh Fields trade is one of the worst in baseball history, you know, at least from a Dodgers standpoint. But once you get all those guys, then you can add free agents around them. You can make the trades that you need to make because your core is in place. And that's exactly what you were, you know, talking about there with the Orioles, where now they're in a position. I mean, I must have read 400 trade proposals between the Orioles and Guardians for Shane Bieber. You know, I mean, as a free agent at the end of the year. But like, the Orioles are in a position to be able to do that now. And they are a brilliantly run front office. Speaking of the Astros, you know, Michael Elias and Sig Mejdal are two guys who came over from the Astros to set up that organization. So, like, they're not going anywhere. And I completely disagree with the people that think that they will step back here, because now they're also in a position where, as you said, they trade from a position of strength in that logjam to get even better in another area.
Yeah, and look, the Yankees have some pitching issues. The Red Sox are not winning, which is like a conversation for another day. The Boston Red Sox just aren't going for it this many years in a row now. I just don't understand it. I mean, the AL East is wide open. You know, the Rays are the Rays. I'm never going to count out the Rays, but the Orioles are the ones on the upswing. So let's do a quick, before we say goodbye here, our predictions for the year. So first off, you want to do awards? Let's look at the MVPs. Who jumps out to you for NL and AL MVP?
I mean, in terms of jumping out, I think this is kind of going to be a pretty chalky award. You know, I mean, if Ronald Acuña Jr. stays healthy, what he did last year was insane. And what he did from a contact quality standpoint was even more insane, especially because he cut his walk rate down substantially, or his strikeout rate down, excuse me, substantially from last season. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, last year, not only was he able to steal a lot of bases because he's really athletic, but he also got on base a ton because he only struck out 11.4% of the time, cut it by more than half, 23.6% in 22. So he hit 41 homers. That could go up if the strikeout rate, you know, gains are legit. 73 stolen bases. Like, if you're doing things that nobody has ever seen before, a la Shohei Ohtani, then, you know, you should be the favorite to win the award. Ohtani won't pitch this year, so I think it makes it a little bit more difficult. That's why he's plus 750. But to me, I think it's Acuña and really everybody else at this point in time. I think the position change could actually hurt Mookie Betts a little bit, because now he's got other things to worry about other than just, you know, going out there and hitting. The one guy that I would say that kind of intrigues me a little bit here, a little bit further down the board, is Austin Riley. The tough thing is the Braves are kind of going to cannibalize each other because so many guys are going to have good numbers. But Austin Riley plays a premier position at third base. He's a guy that's 27, so he's kind of coming into the middle part of the prime of his career. 37 homers last year, but I think there's more in there than that. He could be a 50-type of homer guy like Matt Olson was last year.
I totally agree. If you would have told me Austin Riley last year or Matt Olson were going to hit 45-50 home runs, I would have went Riley. I just think the pure power is absolutely there. I'm going to throw a guy kind of down the betting board near Austin Riley at you. I bet him at 22-1. Corbin Carroll. I don't think we're putting into perspective what he did in his rookie year. Like, he had 285. He had 25 homers. He had 54 steals. If Acuña doesn't have the year he does, Corbin Carroll probably wins the MVP a year ago. And I'm not expecting him to get better from that, but if that's his baseline at 22 years old, I just think Corbin Carroll, we don't even know what the potential is for a guy like that. What if he improves by 5 in both categories? He goes 30-59 or 30-60 somehow and still hits 285. I think Corbin Carroll is a guy that has potential to steal this award if something happens with the guys at the top like Acuña and, you know, Ohtani.
Well, and I think, you know, something you got to keep in mind about young players too. Power is typically the last thing to show up for a lot of the guys that are bat to ball types of dudes. You'll have guys with raw power in the minor leagues that grade out really well, but they're guys with big holes in their swings. They strike out a ton. You know, maybe they walk a lot, which kind of limits their ability to drive the baseball. For Corbin Carroll, you know, I mean, this is a guy that I think the power can develop a little bit more. And the other thing I think is worth pointing out too, he hit 18 of his 25 home runs in the first half last year. So you could make an argument that he maybe fatigued a little bit, kind of hit, you know, as we would call it for pitchers, a dead arm period in the middle of the season, his first big major league campaign. You know, it's a much higher stress environment, all those kinds of things. He kind of struggled a little bit in the middle part of the season, and that kind of dragged his power production numbers down, where, I mean, this is a guy who was on pace to hit 35 plus. So I don't think that that's a bad way to look at it either. And also, the lineup's gotten a little bit better there too, and I think that helps not only from an exposure standpoint, but also the ability to drive in runs, get those counting numbers, runs scored, RBI, stuff like that. The things that the voters are looking for. Arizona's offense is definitely improved here with a little bit more of a power dimension with a guy like Jock Peterson out there. You know, they've got you know, Randall Grichuk's a guy with a little bit of power whenever he comes back. Yeah, Eugenio Suarez is going to hit some home runs for them, too.
I love that addition.
I love that addition, too, because that's what they were missing last year. They were missing a power element. Suarez and Peterson give you more of that. And again, like, Carroll may be kind of far away from them in the lineup, but if their offense as a whole is better, then you notice Corbin Carroll a little bit more nationally, which is what's important for the voters.
All right, the other MVP award. When we look at AL, obviously Judge, Julio Rodriguez, Juan Soto, Bobby Witt Jr., Yordan. Anyone enticing for you that maybe be a sleeper, or do you think we're going chalk in on this side as well?
I mean, I think there's a good chance that we go chalk here just because of the visibility of, you know, some of these top guys here. I will say this, and again, I mean, I've already mentioned that I'm a, you know, Indians/Guardians fan. This could be the year at 25-1 where Jose Ramirez just completely shines. I mean, you know, the Guardians talked a lot in spring training about not just making contact for the sake of making contact, making quality contact, hitting the ball hard. Generally speaking, you need somebody to lead by example with that. And I could totally see a scenario in which Jose Ramirez gets a little bit selfish, gets a little bit aggressive, cheats on some of those inner half fastballs, tries to really drive them and sort of be the poster child for that organizational, you know, philosophical change. I think at 25-1, if the Guardians are going to be really good, and I think there's a path to do that, I think he's an interesting guy. The other one for me is Kyle Tucker for the Astros. He's in the 17-1 range. You know, I don't think we really talk about this enough, but Kyle Tucker's a guy that stole 30 bases last year. He was one home run away from being a 30-30 guy, and he's a guy increased walk rate last year, improved upon his strikeout rate, batted 284, which was, you know, an upgrade from the 257 he had the year before. That's a guy that I think has an extra gear. And the Astros will once again be a good lineup. He's hitting at the top of it. I think Kyle Tucker's a guy that, you know, because of what he provides all around, yeah, I think he's very much in that discussion.
I think he's a great option because Yordan Alvarez is 8-1 over at DraftKings right now, Adam. Yordan Alvarez, statistically, his first few years of his career have compared literally to David Ortiz when David Ortiz broke out. He just can't stay on the field. I think there's an element where Tucker, I also think, look, I took a flyer on Jose Altuve at 60-1 just because I thought when he came back from injury last year, he was tremendous. My favorite AL MVP bet though was Vlad Guerrero Jr. 22-1. We can get into it in a moment. I am absurdly high on the Blue Jays, but I would warn everyone, I've been really high on the Blue Jays for a few years now, but I think at like 25, 26 years old, like, this is the year Vlad Guerrero Jr. could finally put it together. So I think that team with the power potential, it's all there, but I agree with you on Jose Ramirez. Jose Ramirez and Ozzie Albies are the two guys that don't play for my team that I wish played for my team. I just love watching them play. They contribute across the board. They make smart baseball decisions all the time. They have great at-bats. I think they're both complete throwbacks. All right, so let's do our World Series. Tell me your matchup. I'll tell you my matchup, and then we'll tell each other our winners. So who's your matchup for the World Series?
So I'm going to be real boring with this one. Maybe I've been boring throughout the show. Hell if I know. Orioles and Braves. I think the Orioles are just incredibly good, and I think what we talked about earlier is something that will come to fruition. If the Guardians are out of it, or they decide that the Orioles give them a package that they can't refuse for Shane Bieber, and Shane Bieber appears fixed, by the way, based on spring training and his offseason work, the Orioles will get somebody to give them Burns, Rodriguez, and then pitcher to be determined in, you know, a 1-2-3 setting to be in a 5-game or a 7-game series. They will go get someone. And I think the bullpen's really good, and they can, again, trade from positions of strength. I think they will get better as the season goes along. And then for Atlanta, I mean, if Max Fried is healthy in a contract year, like, he's going to be really good. Spencer Strider added a curveball. He may be even better, which is disgusting to think about. But also, I don't know if he'll stay healthy. I am really hoping he does. Chris Sale looked really good in the spring. And, you know, with the Braves and the depth and the intelligence of that organization, I don't think they have to rely on him to throw 180 innings. If he gives them 120 innings and he's relatively healthy for the playoffs, they very much take that. I think Atlanta is the best team in baseball. And I think Baltimore, you could make a case is maybe the second or third best team.
Yeah, I think the Chris Sale deal is just they signed him simply to be healthy for October. That's all that matters. If they have to rest him, if they have to IL him during the year, if they have to do whatever, the whole goal is that that guy's 100% throwing heaters in the playoffs. All right, so my World Series, I've got a double bird matchup, and mine does not involve the Baltimore Orioles. First, the Blue Jays. I mentioned how much I love Vlad Guerrero Jr. I think this is a big year for the Blue Jays. I know Gausman's getting off to a rough start with some arm pain, but Berríos had a very strong season a year ago, even though everyone loves to crap all over that guy. Bassett is one of the most consistent guys in all of baseball every single year. Kikuchi was shockingly good last year. And then can you get anything out of Alek Manoah? That's what it comes down to for me. I think the bullpen is really solid, and I think that's what separates a lot of these teams. Do you have a serviceable bullpen versus just a useless bullpen? And I think when you look at the bats for Toronto, they're as live as anyone. I think Dalton Varsho, year two, will improve in Toronto. I don't think the contact and the average was quite as what everyone was looking for a year ago. But I think it's a big year for Bo Bichette and for Vladdy Guerrero Jr. But Bichette had a monster season last year. I had him 70-1 to win the MVP, Adam. I thought he should have been closer to in the mix. Obviously, when Ohtani exists, it's hard to do that. But Vlad Guerrero Jr., I think he's on the verge of potentially a monster season here. So while everyone's talking about the Yankees, I don't think the Yankees have enough pitching in that division right now with Cole on the shelf, with Rodon looking rough in spring training at times. I think the Blue Jays are going to win that division, and I think the Blue Jays have the depth and the experience to make a run in the postseason this year. My other team, I can't quit this team either. I just think when I look at the moves they made, they got adults now. They were throwing garbage out there in their starting rotation, the St. Louis Cardinals, a year ago. I think they lengthened their rotation. They're absolutely built for 162 now. Kyle Gibson's an innings eater. His ERA may not be amazing. He may not strike out a lot of guys. He's going to take the wear and tear off the bullpen. I think Sonny Gray was a really good addition. I think St. Louis is the perfect fit for him. You bring back guys like Michaelis, who's now at 100% health. Lance Lynn, look, if he's your fourth or fifth starter, I don't hate him. I don't know what he is. It's been a long time since he's been good. I like the bullpen. I like Helsley. Gallegos throws fire. They bring in Kittredge from Tampa Bay, and they have a few other guys who potentially pop there. But I think when you look at the lineup, they have depth. They can withstand a couple injuries here or there, and they're going to have to because Tommy Edman's starting the year on the IL. I think the Cardinals are a team where you look at the corners. I think Arenado has a bounce back year. I think Goldschmidt improves a little bit off of last year. He's getting a little bit older. But I think this could be the breakout for a Jordan Walker type season. And you still have guys like Brendan Donovan and Dylan Carlson who have all this upside who can play. And Nolan Gorman. I mean, he's got pure power. He just doesn't have a position to play at the moment, so they're going to move him second, third, DH. I think the Cardinals are a dangerous team, especially over 162. So I'm going to take a shot on them versus the Blue Jays in the World Series with the Blue Jays winning. Who's your winner?
I think my winner is Atlanta, but I think that would be a remarkable series and a really good showcase of all the young talent around Major League Baseball. If we did get something like the Orioles and the Braves, whereas, you know, you're kind of looking at a couple of teams that, you know, are more veteran laden. And maybe that just kind of speaks to a little bit of the difference between you and I that, you know, we'll explore here throughout the life cycle of this podcast. But look, I know this, you know, I think that the game, despite Rob Manfred's best efforts, I think the game is in a really good spot with all of these young players to promote that Major League Baseball fails to promote, that hopefully they'll do a better job of. But it is such an exciting game now. The increase in stolen bases last year, the ball wasn't dead at any point in time. It's an exciting game right now. I'm really looking forward to this season. I'm looking forward to this show with you throughout the season as well.
Yeah, man, we're going to do it. Check for the podcast every single Monday, every single Thursday. That's when we will record them. They'll drop a little bit after. So I think this was a good way to end the first edition of Double Play, a baseball podcast for Adam Burke. I'm Dustin Sweetelson. We will see you next time right here.